The moon hid itself behind the clouds. The wind spat an icy snow at angles. In the tall black wall of the palisade, through a slit too seeming thin for human passage, the girl climbed into the great and terrible wilderness. Over her face, she wore a hood drawn low, and she was slight, both bony and childish small, for the famine had stripped her down yet starker to root and string and fiber and sinew. Even so, starved and blinded by the dark, she was quick. She scrabbled upright, stumbled with her first step, nearly fell, but caught herself, and began to run, going fast over the frozen ruts of the field and all the stalks of dead corn that had come up in the summer, already sooty and fruitless and stunted with blight. Swifter girl, she told herself, and in their fear and anguish, her legs moved yet faster.
So begins an escape into the wilds of Virginia, as they were some 400 years ago, as told in the 2023 novel The Vaster Wilds by Lauren Groff. The New York Times bestselling author has four other novels to her credit and two collections of short stories, among other things. And she graduated from the UW-Madison with a Master of Fine Arts degree in fiction. And we'll find out about how this author of books and stories with so many different settings puts the same style to all of them, if indeed she does. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. And welcome to University of the Air, Lauren Groff.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be on.
Now you have written books that are more or less contemporary in their settings, books and stories. You have written a book that is set in the 12th century and even more recently, this latest book, just out this year, The Vaster Wilds, set in the year 1609 or 1610, a luxury that not any writer would be able to enjoy, that kind of variety of place and time in their writing. What would you say would be the characteristic Lauren Groff style that would tie these writings together?
Well, I think that's actually a question for critics, not for me, because my face is pressed up against the lines, right? I can't even see the way that the books respond to one another as well as other people could. But I take a lot of pains with the sentences. I actually thought for Matrix and for The Vaster Wilds, since they were set in such vastly different periods, with such profoundly unusual source material that I was working with, I really wanted to echo the styles and the periods in each book. So with Matrix, I really did pay a lot of attention to the syntax and language of medieval stories and liturgical writings. And then with The Vaster Wilds, I really got into the Elizabethan. I found so much joy and pleasure in understanding not only the rhythms and the meter of the sentences, but also the way that metaphors unfurl in a different way than they do for us in the 21st century.
And I would say that your metaphors in The Vaster Wilds are much tighter than they are in, say, Fates and Furies. And maybe we'll get into stylistic development a little later, but let's get into some commonalities first. The Matrix, your 2021 book set in the 12th century, and we have an exile from one community to another, and Marie by name, and she steadily supplants her desire for family, for her homeland, for the passions of her youth with something new, which would be her devotion to her sisters in this convent context, and then a conviction of her own divine visions. Now, if you compare that with the character in The Vaster Wilds, which she has so many names that, in fact, she doesn't really have a name, the character. You refer to her mostly as just the girl, and we can get into the naming of things, too. But she has none of those things, it seems to me, none of those advantages that buoy up Marie in Matrix. She loses community, she loses faith, and she certainly loses her physical well-being. Was that later book, The Vaster Wilds, was that your thinking of just let's take everything away from this character and see how she responds?
Yeah, well, I wrote both of these books and a third book that I'm still working on all together at the same time. And these books all circle around the same, very similar thematic ideas, even though they are radically different each, and they each stand on their own, I hope. But so, as you said, in Matrix, Marie is really deeply invested in developing community around herself as almost a shell, as she herself becomes a cathedral for the nuns that she is taking care of. And with this one, I did want to think about isolation, loneliness, solitude, what community actually means in those periods, and whether or not community is always a good thing, or whether radical isolation, as we often love it in the United States of America, is a good thing too. So yeah, they have very similar obsessions with community and the individual.
In The Vaster Wilds, those are extremes, though. The community is an extreme, something to be escaped. I mean, the character, I'll just call her the girl, although Lamentations is one of her names, and that's certainly appropriate. But the girl escapes some horrific circumstances and events in early Jamestown.
Oh, boy, yeah. That winter, the 1609-1610 starving time winter, was so horrific. Something like 80% of all colonists died of starvation or violence or freezing to death or the brackish water or poxes and plagues. I mean, it was just a horrific, horrific time. So the girl going out into nature, sort of trying to understand her own relationship to nature and to the community that she left, all of these things really propel her through the book.
Well, if we're looking at that winter of 1609 and 1610 in particular, nobody's really having a very good time, are they? Even in her relatively, I'll say, luxurious life before she comes to Jamestown, it was not a happy time. It was a brutal time, actually.
It was a great time for a few certain select people, I think, right? I mean,
great time to have money.
Yeah, I know, exactly, right? It's a wonderful time to have money. If you were Queen Elizabeth, you were doing fine, or there would be King James at that point. But yeah, it was not a good time, especially to be a foundling servant girl without family, right? Sent out to work at 4 years of age. Because of the religion and the ideas sort of that held her and that she was born into, which was that since she was poor and since she was female, she was not of the elect, and therefore there was no chance for her to go to heaven, right? So immediately from day one, she was inferior and she was kept in an inferior position. So she's a person who has worked really hard all of her life. She loves very deeply, very profoundly. And she, you know, when her family, the family that she is a servant for, decides to go to the New World, she is not even asked whether or not she wants to come. She is just, it's taken for granted that she will. So in this book, this person who has no autonomy at all throughout the course of her life suddenly takes her own autonomy into her own hands and flees. And I think that is the beginning explosion that pushes her into the rest of the narrative.
She doesn't seem to have this sense of maybe things will be somehow better in the New World when she is told she's going to go.
I mean, she's kept so busy, I don't think she has time to actually think about it. You know, I mean, she's doing everything, and she's basically nursemaid mother of the young child in the family, too. I mean, she has to do so much work. I don't think she really thinks it through, or she really understands what it is that her family is making her do.
But she has a structure, at least, in her, well, certainly her employment, if you want to call it that, her servitude would be a better word. And she also has a structure, as you've alluded to, Lauren, in her religion. which is telling her, of course, that she's not one of the elect, not one of the ones who's going to go to heaven. But there is this hierarchy that she has a sense of place in, whereas what happens when she gets to Jamestown?
Well, when she gets to Jamestown, it's a horrific time for everyone. And those hierarchies are breaking down because everyone's dying around her, right? And they're being raided by the Native Americans, who are understandably very upset by the way that they've been treated by the colonists. And so this girl, you know, suddenly she has to start really taking responsibility, and she has to start trying to go find food, and she has to start doing things on her own. So terrible things happen. I don't want to, you know, do spoilers, no, but terrible things happen in in the fort, and she takes off. And now the only thing she's responsible for is trying to make it to where she believes. She doesn't even know where other European people are, right? She knows that there are Frenchmen to the north and Spanish people to the south. She has no perception of how vast North America is. She's coming from England, where it's, you know, it's a smaller geographical amount of space. So I think she probably thinks there's a parallel. But to be perfectly honest, she is illiterate. Right? She is not someone who has ever, nobody has ever given her an education. So she doesn't know what she doesn't know. And this, I would like to think that this ignorance rings with some irony throughout the whole book.
She'd have a lot of company, though, in that kind of ignorance, because even, I'm guessing, a lot of the settlers in Jamestown had really very little idea of how far St. Augustine would be or how far Quebec would be.
Oh, correct. Exactly. I mean, even if you look at the maps of the time, the maps of the people of that area where they were going up the rivers and sailing and trying to draw the Chesapeake Bay, those maps are, let's just say, not accurate, right? I mean, yeah. At one point, very close to this time period, someone thought that the Chesapeake Bay led into the Northwest Passage, which would bring people across into the Pacific.
A little bit of a portage there.
Right. A little bit. Yes.
We have become accustomed in America, in particular, of thinking of the frontier representing freedom and individualism. How does she think of the frontier, which then would have been virtually right outside the door of the fort at Jamestown?
I am so glad you asked this question, because you are absolutely correct. This is a frontier narrative. I am obsessed with frontier narratives. Absolutely. From day one, I've been obsessed, primarily because I come from Cooperstown, New York, where James Fenimore Cooper is from. He was our first major novelist in the United States, and he was a frontier novelist.
Yes.
I mean, Cooperstown was on the New York frontier when his father founded the town. And all of the, you know, his Pathfinder, Natty Bumppo, Leatherstocking, all the same person, but all of these narratives that he wrote were frontier narratives. And I believe that this genre, which has turned into the Western, comes out of a very particular form of American literature, which is one of the first forms of American literature, which is the captivity narrative. These were primarily female voices captured and edited by male church people like Increase Mather and Cotton Mather that depicted what happened on the frontier to primarily women who were kidnapped and then ransomed by the Native Americans. And they're fascinating texts in and of themselves. They're also fascinating to see how profoundly propagandistic they are for the Western expansion. I mean, these are really kind of, I mean, from a 21st century, they're really, really problematic narratives. I mean, they're there to justify genocide in a lot of ways. So I do think a lot of the frontier narratives that we are talking about, that we're thinking about now, going through the ages, going through, say, Cormac McCarthy, Lonesome Dove,
sure,
Annie Proulx, all these narratives, they sort of had their roots in Captive and Naive narratives through the figure of Natty Bumppo from Cooper's narratives, and they sort of almost congealed in a very weird way into this iconoclastic, laconic cowboy type that upheld hierarchy and masculinity and patriarchy and Western expansion and bigotry. I mean, the Western as in its own genre is really, really not. It's an artifact to uphold the worst parts of America, I believe. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it is interesting that in some of those captivity narratives, if you get right behind the narrative, in some cases, those people rescued really preferred to stay with the Native Americans.
Yes, exactly. But those narratives tended not to be told,
right?
Because it doesn't buy into the overall propaganda of the time. But I love this idea now in the 21st century with people's awareness of what happened in this country, that the Western is being gutted and turned inside out and made strange and made queer and made unusual, like Hernan Diaz is in the distance, Sipam Zhang's How Much of These Hills Are Gold. It's really, it's a new and exciting kind of frontier in frontier narratives. I think it's really interesting.
And perhaps ironically, if you go back and look at some of the earliest of those frontier narratives, I'm thinking of the adventures in the unknown interior of America, Cabeza de Vaca. He was writing events that he experienced in the 1540s. And it's a very different America, even from what you're referring to, Lauren, is in these, frontier narratives. It's a very different place and relationship, let's say, with the inhabitants.
Absolutely. I love Cabeza de Vaca. I love those books. I think they're really, really fascinating to read. But I do have a feeling that it comes out of the religions, the separate religions. I mean, at the time, right, in the early 16th century, of course, in Spain, that would be Catholicism. And with the English coming to the New World, that was very, very Anglican, right? I mean, it was very, it was not Catholic. In fact, they had a lot of things that were directly opposed to the Catholic Church,
sure.
Right? So I think the difference may be found in the religion at the time.
I'm guessing that the Anglicans probably weren't quite as interested as the Catholics in conversion, and the Catholics, to some extent, considered the Spanish movement into the New World as an extension of, the Inquisition or the extension of Catholicism. Whereas I'm not sure if you get that feeling from the so-called pilgrims in New England.
Yeah, definitely the pilgrims, of course, are a little bit later from the time that we're talking about. You're right. But I do have to say, they did justify outfitting these enormous ships in the very, very early 17th century and late 16th century from England in order to spread the gospel to the Native Americans. I mean, there was a very real urgency, but it wasn't the same. There's a very real difference between the Spanish and the English at the time. And I think you're right that the missionary zeal was of a higher degree with the Spanish colonists.
We're going to look further at the wilds and nature in particular, and also the element of loneliness in the writings of Lauren Groff, and we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest Lauren Groff, novelist of considerable note, New York Times bestselling author, and also an alumna of the UW-Madison Master of Fine Arts program. And we've gotten into this theme of the wilderness in America as it was in the early 17th century. That's the setting for her latest book, The Vaster Wilds, and also the theme of religion. And I wanted to touch at least on another, I think, common thread in your writing, Lauren, and that is the theme of loneliness, particularly as it pertains to young women or girls. Because if we do a little flashback here to an earlier book of yours, Fates and Furies, we have a character named Mathilde, who has, in a way, a similar childhood experience to that in The Vaster Wilds experienced by the protagonist. And she, too, this is a contemporary setting in Fates and Furies, more or less contemporary. And how do you describe that character's growing up?
Oh, well, Mathilde, you're right. I actually hadn't made that connection, but she was French, and she was raised in a family that rejected her for a reason that I don't want to get into, because that would be spoilers also. And she was shipped around from family member to family member, and eventually took her own life in her own hands and went off to college. And so she is a lonely person. She's maybe not lonely, but she's a solitary person who really has to fight in order to make sure that she can survive. That's very similar to my character in The Vaster Wilds, you're right.
And you want to give us a little reading from that, just so we get some of your language?
Sure. So this is from the first part of Fates and Furies. The little she spoke of childhood was shadowed with abuse. He'd imagined it vividly. Poverty, beat up trailer, spiteful, she implied worse uncle. Her most vivid memories of her childhood were of the television that was never turned off. Salvation of school, scholarship, modeling for spare change. They'd begun to accrete stories between them. How, when she was small, isolated in the country, she'd been so lonely that she'd let a leech live on her inner thigh for a week.
That is a memorable, very sad image of my friend the leech.
My friend the leech.
That's about as lonely as you get.
As we know in the book, the husband who is interpreting all this takes that story as his own and uses
his own. That's right. So it's kind of the ultimate loneliness in a sense. She's been usurped there in her loneliness. I feel perfectly okay with jumping around like this because, of course, your novels, as novels often do, particularly today, jump from one time period to the other. You do a little bit of that in The Vaster Wilds, flashbacks to the girl's experiences before she came to Jamestown. But what about nature? If we look at nature in the writings of the early 17th century in England, I know we're way before the Romantic era, where the lake poets would, you know, wax poetic literally about it. But what were the attitudes, do you think, in early 17th century England about nature, the outdoors?
I mean, I think it would depend on where someone was, right? In the countryside, obviously, there was a little bit more understanding. But where the girl is, she's in London, and it is crowded, it's smoky, it's dirty. People throw their waste onto the ground. You know, it is really cosmopolitan in a way that we'd probably recognize. It'd be different, but it'd be. Somewhat similar. People were packed very closely together. There were a lot of fires that happened because of houses being so close together. So she doesn't understand nature, of course, right? I mean, she goes for walks on Hampstead Heath, but that's about as close to nature as she gets. And maybe the giant Thames running through the river with the sturgeons that come up once in a while, that's as close as she gets. Or the mouse in the pantry, that's as close as she gets. She truly, truly does not understand the natural world until she gets thrust into it with this trip to the New World.
You use this metaphor of putting like a tincture, just a titration, I think is the term you use. You're dropping this one individual drop of humanity into this vast medium of the outdoors, as it was in Virginia of the early 17th century, and kind of watching how the two mix. Is that an apt metaphor for what's going on in the Vaster Wilds?
Yeah, if I put that in the book, it's quite good.
You put it in an interview, actually. I saw it in one of your other interviews. I thought, well, that's a very impressive metaphor. But, and again, we don't want to get into spoiler alerts here, but it's a matter of control and self-control, isn't it, for her once she gets into the wilds. She is her own person. She's a free person, and yet there are so many strictures working against her too. It's a different kind of subjugation in a way.
Oh, of course. And of course, someone like her would have been raised in a religious tradition that saw nature as enemy, right? I mean, like, or something to be dominated instead of something to be understood and worked with, especially in the New World, where there was almost a frantic need for the colonists to burn down the forests around them to create fields and everything. So you know, nature for them was desperate. It was something to be conquered. And as she's going further and further away from the fort, from what she knows, she starts to lose a lot of these strictures, a lot of these a lot of this received wisdom that she hasn't really had time or space or the ability to think about. What I really wanted to do with this book was to write an adventure story that's also a philosophical story. Sure. and try to make the two interdigitated, twisted together.
Which is a challenge to do it without just kind of taking the Tolstoy method and writing several pages of philosophy and then getting back to the story. You have to actually express the philosophy in the story, which must have been a challenge. And she's learning, obviously. She has to survive. But at the same time, as we mentioned earlier, she is staying very much to herself. She sees people occasionally, Native Americans from a distance, and she's seen evidence occasionally, almost like Robinson Crusoe, footprints. Once it's her own, it takes her a while to realize.
Yeah, that's right.
Circled
around.
Yeah,
that's exactly where that. Yeah, that was an homage to Robinson Crusoe, actually. Yeah, yeah.
But she stays to herself, and
she does. Yeah.
She avoids contact with other people.
Well, she doesn't know that she's being watched as she moves through the wilderness. Right? She thinks of herself as being entirely alone in ways that she's not. I think the Native Americans make it very clear that they are watching her go through, but they're not, they don't make contact, right? And when she does see them, she is still in a European mindset, right? So there's this one moment that I like, actually, that where she's on a boat and she's being pushed by the wind up the Chesapeake, and she sees these two little Native American girls on the shore playing with their new puppy. And she thinks that she is so strikingly unusual that she's going to live in their minds forever. But of course, that's putting herself at the center of other people's imaginations, right? And in fact, they just sort of forget about her as soon as she's gone. I had a little bit of fun with that that moment where, you know, the European centrality is not proven to be something that the Native Americans are invested in.
Well, the indifference of those Native Americans and the indifference of nature, as it turns out. I'm reminded of a line from Thoreau, who obviously had a very different relationship with nature. He said, "A man said to the universe, 'Sir, I exist.' And the universe replied, 'That does not create in me a sense of responsibility.'"
I love Thoreau. That is so funny. I love that.
And that's a theme of indifference, actually. Reigns supreme here, I suppose. But she does start out with a faith, a very strong faith, it would seem, that does seem to help her get through some of the hardest times early on.
She does. She does. She has this little burning light of God inside of her. And it's possible that, you know, I took this from my own experiments in faith. One of the most exciting things I've ever done in terms of seeking out religion is going to Quaker meeting. And this is one of the precepts of the Quaker faith, is that everyone has the spark of God in them. And I love that so much. I just love that idea. Right? I mean, it's just, it's one of the more beautiful concepts, conceptualizations of the vast eternal mysteries of God, to understand that everything has the spark of God in it.
Does she?
Yeah.
I was going to ask, does she have a sense of God in nature, harsh as it is?
Well, she starts to understand, yes, of course. Yeah, I think, nature to her over the course of the book becomes something different. It's not something to be combated, right? It's something she's trying desperately to even understand if she pays attention. And the book makes it clear, even though she doesn't necessarily know, that nature's not entirely indifferent, right? I mean, if she knew enough to know where to dig under the snow, she would find mast, right? She'd find hickory nuts and other kinds of delicious nuts that she could render into food.
Grubs.
Grubs, right? Or, ground nuts, which were, the Native Americans really loved ground nuts. And I'm actually very excited about them nowadays. they're these incredible things where you can actually eat them like peas, but also like tubers under the ground. They're really, it's an incredible source of nutrition. And she passes them as she's running through the forest, but she's not aware. She has her colossal ignorance, can't show her that nature is both indifferent and incredibly giving, right? She just can't see it because she's not trained to see it.
There are moments where she has a sense of wonder on page 121, for example, if you want to read that.
The set of her mind then became soft and infinitely open. And as she gazed down into the water, she saw in the depths below her, playing in and out of the boat's shadow, a swift great gray fish that might have been a porpoise, like the ones that had danced around the ship's wake as they rowed across the face of the ocean. And now it came up, came near, and there was something in the shining glimpse, the liquid black eye of the fish gazing up to her as it passed out of the shadow into the light, that made her say yes aloud and gasp.
That's almost a Thoreauvian moment. And again, she has nothing like the relative luxury that he had there at Walden when she's out there in the wilds of Virginia. Also, I think we should add that this was part of a little ice age, wasn't it, when the Jamestown settlement began? It was like the coldest weather in 700 years or something like that.
If it is, it was new to me, or it was, this is information that I had in 2017 when I started the book.
But it's cold.
I've forgotten it in the room.
I mean, this is the winter, and it is cold, and there's ice, and it's unreliable ice. It's shifting ice. It's constantly changing. So she really doesn't know from one moment to the next, shall I escape across the river, or would I drown attempting it, that kind of thing. In other words, it's nature that's even less predictable than usual for her.
Correct. Yes, exactly. Well, yes. I mean, she doesn't know what to fear, right? I mean, she doesn't know what the animals of the New World might be if they're so radically different from anything that she might encounter in Europe. She's running into the darkness of her understanding.
Let's get back to God, if we may, not just in this book, but in some of your others, too. There's definitely a theme, and you've said that you have that you have a great interest in the role of religion in the way these characters work. Is it a spoiler risk if I ask, does she lose her faith in God during this experience in the wilderness?
I think it's transformed. I think there's God as given to her through religion, which is an interpretation of God, right? It's a specific human-sized vision of what God can be. And then there's God as she slowly becomes to understand it when she's alone in the wilderness. And it's not that she loses faith. It's that it transforms into something, I believe, deeper and more interesting.
We're going to look further at the role of various themes in the writings, and we'll get into this sense of place, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Lauren Groff, New York Times bestselling author, and most recently of the novel The Vaster Wilds, published in 2023. We've gotten a lot into the concept of the place, the setting for The Vaster Wilds, in which the setting is a character. I think it's fair to say that, one of the characters in the book. And you have written about some other places, too, though, most notably. How long have you lived in Florida, Lauren?
Oh, I've lived in Gainesville, Florida for 17 years, which is longer than I've ever lived anywhere else, actually.
And a very different landscape. I'm not sure that Wordsworth and Thoreau would have written quite the same lovingly way of nature had they lived in Florida.
And you're only saying this because you're from Gainesville and you have left it long ago. I think Bartram wrote very lovingly about Florida.
Yes, he did. His travels in 1776, a fascinating time to be in Florida, which was one of the colonies that remained faithful to King George, East and West Florida.
That's right.
A little known fact there. However, it's very graphically described in some of your earlier writings. You have, in fact, a whole short story collection called Florida, and you have some descriptions also in Fates and Furies of Florida. And let's get into one of those. That would be page 196 in Fates and Furies.
All the while outside the sun was setting, shadows creeping out of the sea on swift amphibian feet and moving toward the Gulf over the intercoastal waterway, the St. John's River, the cold springs and gatored swamps, the fountains dyed turquoise and the sad, cheap developments half foreclosed upon. Over the mangroves, over the manatees, over the clams in their beds, one by one closing their hard little lips like a choir at the end of a song. There the shadows dove deeper into the Gulf, rolled in their underwater double darkness toward Texas.
That's actually a fairly complimentary view of Florida. And of course, it can be done. There are certainly many moments of beauty and wonder in Florida. You also have a description in one of the other stories in Florida of a hurricane, too, which is quite graphic, although until recently, there haven't been that many hurricanes in Florida, but it has certainly proven another example where nature is particularly unpredictable. And it has been said by somebody, perhaps you remember who, Lauren, some author, that the problem with authors is they're not from anywhere anymore.
Ah, I love that. No, it's true.
and you're from Cooperstown, New York, and you've obviously spent time in Wisconsin, and then 17 years in Florida. Do you find it difficult to write about a place unless you've been there for a fairly long time?
I do, actually. I do have to say, Florida has worked its way into me, and it's now inextricable from who I am in a way that is both lovely and wonderful, because I you know this, but the natural world here is unparalleled, right? The Payne's Prairie is spectacular.
It is.
It's full of birds and bison, and some of the ancestors of the Spanish horses that first came over in the 16th century. I mean, like, it's really kind of an astonishing place. I haven't actually written about Madison because I was only there for 2 years. So
yeah.
I don't think that I have any stories about Madison, but that might change. I do love the place so much. I miss it. I think about the lakes all the time.
It may not have the extremes that you would find in Florida. When you mentioned Payne's Prairie, which, speaking of changing nature, was a lake for much of the time, a sinkhole, an enormous sinkhole that then unclogged automatically back in the 1890s and turned into back into a prairie where buffalo roam and that kind of thing. So writing about Florida, you're writing about a place that is particularly unpredictable, and the more so these days. Do you think it's a relative luxury for a writer to be able to write about so many different places and time settings, or is it really not that big a deal to have that kind of difference? I mean, I've interviewed authors recently who, you know, have written 20 books all set in the same city with the same characters, and that's how you kind of make your niche for your product, if you want to call it that, your books. But you seem to have the freedom to be much more experimental with your writing.
To be honest, my urge when I write a book is to go against what I've done before. You know, sometimes I think that I'm trying to explode the previous book with the next book.
Explode it say, oh, you mean contradicting it in some ways or just being as different as possible?
Trying to actually undermine it with the next book.
Really?
Right? I mean, as soon as a book is in the hands of the readers, it's no longer mine. And maybe I think I need to do this in order to differentiate the next book and to start to make it its own thing. I hope I will never write the same book twice. I hope that I will continue to surprise and delight myself when I come to the page and find something unusual, something strange to me to write about. And, you know, I have to say, both Florida and upstate New York are incredibly strange places, right? I mean, like, really bizarre. And if I end up living in Paris, I'm sure I'll find it really strange too. Well,
I'm sure that's true. Do you have a sense of audience when you're writing a book, or is this just Lauren Groff in her mindset and in her most recent experiences or her most recent thoughts, just self-expressing and then maybe tailoring it for an audience? Or where does the audience come in when you write?
Yeah, I intentionally try not to think about the audience until the very last draft when I'm putting my handwritten words or trying to read them and put them on the screen. It's not that it's self-expressing. It's more like I'm engaging in really serious play. That's what writing is to me, right? It's serious play in the way that if you watch a child, and I have two, play all day with Legos, right? They're really figuring things out, right? They're really understanding the way that color mixes and the way that you can construct a whole edifice. And, they're really like, they're serious about what they're doing, but it's still play. And what they're doing is they're failing really joyously. And so that's what I'm trying to do with my first drafts. I'm actually reaching for the farthest realms of failure that I can get to, because that shows me what I can do and what I can't do. And if I need to change the project in order to fit what I can do, or if I can push the boundaries of what I can't do a little bit farther. So I embrace this idea of failure. I think that play is failure up into the very last part, when I'm trying then to take this slowly built platonic ideal and put it onto the page so that someone else can interpret it in their own way.
What percent of the writing experience is fun for you?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, great.
If it's miserable to me, it's going to be miserable to the writer or to the reader, right? I mean, like... I only have fun when I'm, I have to say that it's with fiction, that's true. With nonfiction, it's pure misery for me, like, all day long. So yeah, that's why I write one article every single year, because it's like pulling teeth. But no, fiction for me, this is part of my philosophy of it, right? I really feel like if it's, if it's giving back the light I'm shining into it, then it's something that is worthy of my attention and my time. And if it's not, well, then maybe it will open up later in the future when I'm ready to give it what it needs.
Is The Vaster Wilds being your most recent book? I mean, very recent. The print is still warm. Is that still your favorite book, or is it the one you're working on now?
It's always the one I'm working on now. Yes, you knew that answer before you even asked it, the question. Yes.
It would perhaps be different for each author, but I've never heard another author say that it was otherwise. Do you feel that your style has changed in the last several books? Now, of course, with The Vaster Wilds and with Matrix, you're writing in a deliberately archaic style, but overall, in terms of your message and just your overall approach to writing a book, do you feel that has changed over the last few books?
I don't. You know, I'm looking at the project as a project whole in and of itself, and it requires what it requires from me, and from my voice and my style. And each book being so different needs something completely different. So I like to think that, obviously, unless you're writing something really formulaic, you have no idea what you're about to get into when you start a book, right? You're sort of, you're going sailing, but as you're pushing off, you have to make the boat also, right? I mean, it's a really difficult thing to do. And I think that the less you know about how to write the book, the more exciting it is to write it.
I'm gathering you don't use an outline then. You just kind of follow a general concept and see how things develop?
Well, I do many, many drafts. So the first draft is just like, it looks like a bird's nest. It's like, it's horrific. It's just a disaster. And I write longhand all the way through.
Do you?
And yes. Yeah. And then I put it to the side. I start over again. I put it to the side. I start over. I can't read my own handwriting, obviously. So it's what it is I'm really just figuring out the characters, the structure, the tone, the colors, everything that a book requires in this process of draft catharsis, right? And then finally, I can hold the whole book in my head by the last draft and then really work on what I love, which is the syntax and the sentences and the beautiful layers that you're trying to invest into the book.
It sounds like there's a favorite part of the writing process for you, even though you enjoy it all 100%.
Well, I mean, only insofar as I have some OCD, and I really, really enjoy like the sentence making part. But if I let myself do that from the first draft, I would never get a draft done. So it's, yeah, you have to work with your own weaknesses for sure.
Occasionally, you will give what I'd call alternate endings. You have one in The Vaster Wilds, and it's cleverly done in that the character, the girl, imagines another ending for her story.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think it's because I'm uncomfortable with there only being a single story of any event in the world, obviously. I mean, this is something that recurs again and again in my work that I'm just realizing at the moment as I'm speaking. I don't love the idea of the one true story, right? Because stories change depending on the person telling them or receiving them. And of course, any novel that you put into the world is not finished until it reaches the reader, who does 50% of the work of imagining this book into being. And so it's a gorgeously prismatic and shifting art form, which I love so dearly because it's unpredictable the way that someone else is going to receive something that you thought you're putting down, right? It's all a great and subtle mystery, and it's not a precise art form in the most glorious way.
Would you say that The Vaster Wilds is a poem, an epic poem, in effect. If you just broke the lines differently, it would almost come out like something from long ago, almost one of those Keatsian, you know, epic poems. So
I have to say, Norman, I love you for saying that, because I did write a whole draft in iambic pentameter.
I did.
That was one of the most fun times I've ever had writing anything in my entire life. It was so bad, but it was so fun.
It's a tall order.
I started my literary life as a poet, and you know, the world conspired to tell me that I'm not a poet, but I do like writing poetry, and I really, really enjoyed that draft.
Yeah, I guess I would be reminded ever so slightly in a very different style of Song of Hiawatha, for example, that kind of thing.
Oh my goodness, Longfellow, wow.
Yeah, well, Americana, and again, you know, with a very deliberate verse form and talking about the American frontier.
Oh, interesting. I have to go back and reread that now. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, I know we're to time, so it's been a great pleasure, and I'll look forward to reading the next one, whatever it may be.
Thank you. It was so delightful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
And a great pleasure, Lauren Groff. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.